Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Friends, Romans, countrymen, it's time for... Yes, as the gladiators come in, lend me your ears. Of course, the Friends, Romans, Nightlife listeners too, I suppose we should say, is a line borrowed from one of Shakespeare's most famous plays, Julius Caesar, in which Mark Antony continues, "I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. So let it be with Caesar." Tonight we're going to take a trip back in time to the late Roman Republic and exploring the life of one of history's most famous men, Julius Caesar. We're talking about Rome in the lead-up to a very exciting exhibition opening at the National Museum of Australia in Canberra that opens on Friday this week. It's entitled Rome, City and Empire. And in a nod to that, we've decided tonight to don our togas, cast the die across the Rubicon, and explore the life of the most famous Roman of them all. We use that phrase all the time, cross the Rubicon, don't we? It's entered the popular imagination. What did it actually mean? Why did he have to cross anyway, apart from practical reasons? How much do you know about Caesar? Was he a force for good or evil? Did he single-handedly destroy the Roman Republic? Why was he such an extraordinary military commander? And what legacy did he leave us? All these questions and more to be answered tonight by our two guests. Catherine Welsh is an Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Classics and Ancient History at Sydney University and joins us in the studio. Catherine, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for wearing your toga. And Tom Hillard is an Honorary Associate Professor in the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie University. Tom, great to have you on board as well.
Thank you very much.
You've had to leave, of course, all daggers at the door, which is only proper in this modern Roman forum. Why is Caesar so famous? Was he the most successful general? Was he the most successful political leader, Catherine?
He was a most successful author. This was part of what we can talk about. Yes, he was a great general, and he was a great politician and very famous. And as you say, his death resonates through the ages and is a particular locus for movies and plays and as it was, it has been in the past and it is now. But he is also an author. He got to write up his own adventures, and I think this is a big part of the story.
So to the victors go the spoils, and history is written by the winners, but history has to be written in the first place. You're saying, he wrote about himself, but others wrote about him too, didn't they?
They did. Yeah. They did.
So he was more written about than other Romans?
Yes. He was also, of course, the progenitor of the first dynasty of emperors in Rome, and so they had a vested interest in promoting his story. He's the first Roman to be officially deified directly after his death, or 2 years after his death. He gets official cult in Rome, so he's actually among the Roman pantheon of gods. The story, the fallout, the fact that his death, as it is at this point between Republic and Empire, for whatever, whether he caused it or not, it's still a great moment and a great story in Roman history. It's the absolute essence of what we study when we look at the transition. So, I mean, it's a nexus of reasons for why he would be famous.
That's right. It's not a monarchy. It's not the empire hasn't started. The Roman Empire hasn't. It's not called that. It's the Roman Republic still at this stage, isn't it?
Yes.
Tom, what's his part in it? Where is he? Where's he born? Can you just sketch his early life for us, will you?
Oh well, he's born in Rome. He's from one of the most ancient Roman households. Mm. The Roman ancient aristocracy is called the patricians. We use patricians of just any aristocracy, but the Romans had a certain sort of dozen families that went right back to the time of the kings, right back to the beginning. But it wasn't a family that had actually achieved very much by the time.
So he had blue blood, though.
He had the bluest blood
that
was around. In fact, he had some divine blood running in there as well, because they like to trace themselves back legendarily to the one of the founding fathers, in a way, Aeneas, and Aeneas was the son of Venus. So he actually liked to think that he was actually born. Mm-hmm. For what they could claim that they had gods in the family closet.
Okay, so he's born into noble lineage, but he's born into the Roman Republic. Just explain that for us, Catherine, because there's no Roman Empire. It's a kind of democracy, in a way.
I call it participatory democracy. If we understand the Athenian models, very, very, very different. There were many more restrictions in Rome, but it is participatory, and the whole principle, whether the fact of this measured up or not, the whole principle is divide the power, you know, have fragmentary power so that no one person holds all the power at any given time, except in a very short-lived emergency. And that emergency office was called the dictatorship, but the Romans hadn't used that for well over 100 years, except in one very important case. So you fragment power, you limit the more powerful the office, the shorter time you held it. And the more powerful the office, you always had at least one colleague and usually more. So you shared power. So that's kind of the system he comes into. And, of course, in his own time, he's going to dominate that system by the end. So it's that story also between participatory government and then finally coming under the control of one person.
So he's born in 100 BC. Yep. By the time he dies, the Republic's over. Not quite.
No. You see, the Romans didn't know that the Republic was over, so they killed him.
I just want to quote you, as a consequence of his death, in a sense, the end of the Republic.
Even then, they never quite gave up. That the idea of the Republic hangs around, the idea that one person should not control Rome, or if they did, then there shouldn't be a dynastic process where that person's heir automatically becomes a ruler. The mentality of the Republic actually has some very interesting traces going forward, and that's really important as well.
Okay, Julius Caesar is born into blue blood. His family hasn't done much for a while. He seeks office, though, and he's made at one point, soon after he comes of age, the high priest of Jupiter.
Yes.
Why is that important, Tom?
History would have been extraordinarily different had he gone on being the high priest of Jupiter. Mm. He comes to adulthood at a time of civil war in Rome, and that's obviously changing the ball game very much. There's a war, and Caesar has, as Catherine and I were just talking about a little while ago, has links to both sides of that civil war. But his uncle is one of the leaders on one side, Marius, and he's related also to the... he's actually married to the granddaughter of Sulla, who's on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And that has changed the ballgame because in that moment of the First Civil War, a Roman army is actually marched on Rome for the first time. This is one of those things for which a state never turns back. Once an army has interfered in politics, everyone's always waiting for it to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
So the Republic's already...
So the Republic was already fracturing.
It's fracturing, yes. So he comes in at a time when that civil war is on, and because of his links with one side who gains the power in Rome, his uncle Marius, in fact, he is given this job of Flamandialis, the priest of Jupiter. Now, if he had remained the priest of Jupiter, he would never have been able to get on a horse.
Yeah.
He would never be able to be out of Rome for more than 3 days. He was never allowed to own a dog. His fingernail clippings had to be buried under a sacred tree. I mean, there are all sorts of taboos.
But he doesn't remain the high priest of Jupiter because he becomes Julius Caesar. Catherine, why does he join the army?
Everybody did.
Yeah.
Because
he joins the army, doesn't he?
Well, you kind of think about joining the army. The whole idea of a city-state in antiquity, and Rome still had this mentality, was that every citizen served in the army in their capacity. So it was, and then we're also talking here about the elite classes in Rome, where every young male member of the elite would have some kind of military training, and the whole basis of your public life began in the military situation. So whatever was going on, you would join in. So it's not a case of joining the army as a career choice. This is ubiquitous. Everybody takes a part in.
And is prowess in the military a prerequisite for rising? In Rome?
Not necessarily, but it was possibly the biggest.
So is that why he does it?
Well, again, you've got to think yourself back into the mentality of the time where, as I said, every single young man would play a role in some kind of military capacity. And if you were a member of one of these top classes, you would certainly play the biggest role you could. But Tom's just pointed out that this is a civil war. So, in fact, there's lots of opportunity for young men to make a splash in a military setting if they're any good at fighting and if they're prepared to take a side. So Caesar's future enemy, Pompey, gets the jump on all of this by bringing three legions along to one of the civil war leaders and said, here's my three legions, what are you going to do with me? Oh, thank you very much, go and fight this war for me. And Pompey just did not have to undergo the normal career because he turns up with three legions. Caesar, on the other side, he doesn't have that opportunity, but of course he takes part in military operations because you did. This is what you did. This is your life.
How's the army organised? Is it owned by people of you know, worth, or does the state run the army?
No, it's actually run by the state.
Yeah.
And as Catherine was saying, this is the important thing about the Republic, that you have an annual turnover of government. That there are three main planks to the Roman Republic. One is, as Catherine was saying, you always have a colleague, mm-hmm. so you have collegiality. Mm-hmm. The other is that government turns over every year. There's an annuality. And the other thing is that the government is voted in by the people.
That's right. And it's a kind of democracy, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, kind of.
And you only stay there for a year. That's right. You only stay there for a year.
That's the idea. Yes. And that the army is actually... every male citizen with property is obliged to make himself available at the levy. The idea, initially in the Republic, idea was that the Roman army was a citizen militia. Mm. And every person over the age of 17, it was, as Catherine was saying, it was a formative adolescent experience for most Roman males and aristocrats amongst them, because they would want to get out in front if they wanted a career. So the army was a state army. However, in that period that we were just talking about a moment ago of the Civil War, you actually see the rise of warlords, where people are actually... We had a military reform. The army becomes different. In 107 BC, so it's just before Caesar's born, Marius, the general, who was actually would be Caesar's uncle, mm-hmm. Marius opens up the army to anybody who wants to join. Up until that time, you had to be a property owner. So there was the sense of the citizen militia, the land-owning people who would fight for their own property. However, from the time of Marius on, anybody who wanted to join the army could. Mm-hmm. So you have the beginnings of a professional army, and those professional armies were very loyal to their generals.
How does he go, Catherine, as a soldier? He's apparently quite good.
He is very good, but there's a little bit of water to go under the bridge first, because remember, he's on the wrong side of the Civil War, so he's not going to get the jobs that someone on the right side of the Civil War would get. And indeed, by pledging support or maintaining public support for Marius, the loser, Uncle Marius, the loser in this civil war, and his political heirs, because Marius dies, but the war keeps going, Caesar has to leave Rome for a little bit. So he
has to get out of town.
He has to get out of town. And so he has quite a number of adventures, as we're told in the biographies, in this period when he's out of town, including being captured by pirates and a visit to the court of King Nicomedes of Bithynia.
Now, this is an interesting one, isn't it? Because he spends quite a bit of time at King Nicomedes' court, and some people say he's been hanging around King Nicomedes quite a lot. In fact, he's been probably hanging around the king himself quite a lot. In fact, he's having a relationship. He's gay, was he?
Well, no other evidence actually supports it, but I think, in fact, the whole idea was to slur Julius Caesar. That's the most important part of the story.
Was homosexuality frowned upon?
Depended.
Tom?
I should problematize that. We now, when talking about the ancient world, put homosexuality in single inverted commas. So I'm doing little scare quotes here. Mm-hmm. Because homosexuality is actually a new term. And the Romans didn't actually have a term for it. To be brutally frank, the Romans could seek the Romans from the well-to-do classes could seek their pleasure from any quarter that they liked from their slaves. Okay. Male or female.
So it wasn't, young or old.
Young or old.
So and, there wasn't necessarily a...
And so a person who sought the pleasures to be derived from a slave of either sex was not classed as anything.
Right.
However, the Romans did have a very strong sense of people allowing their bodies to be used by other people. So
you couldn't set up house as a gay couple, could you, as a homosexual man?
No, that wouldn't really have gone down in the Roman aristocracy, because one of them would have to be the passive partner. So the Romans have this very strong sense of who plays the passive role.
Mm.
And as long as you're playing an active role, you are not categorized as anything. So the person playing the active role is not.
Okay, so he may have been gay, but we don't. But with the, apart from the episode at King Nicomedes Court, there's no other evidence, is there, Catherine?
Absolutely none. In fact,
so it may have been a slur.
He was supposed to be the alpha male, yes, working his way through all the women of Rome. This is the big story of that gets through as well. It was a way of it was a common way to criticize someone, and the Romans were very fond of this kind of free speech. There were no holds barred when it came to criticizing your political opponents. There's nothing like a libel law, nothing like a slander law or whatever. You could make stuff up all the time, but this one stuck.
Tell me about the pirates. The pirate story is great because, in fact, it's such a great story that the was appropriated lock, stock and barrel by Game of Thrones.
Was it? Okay. Ignorance.
Tell us. No, that's okay, because the original story is better. Tell us the story of when Caesar was captured by pirates.
The original story, it's very indicative. It's probably not true, but it's too good not to tell. So anyway, he gets captured by pirates. Pirates were a big threat in this time until the middle 60s. Mm. They were a huge threat. And so it was a common thing that you could be captured by pirates. Many stories about being captured by pirates. So Caesar's captured by pirates, and he's such a charming person that he gets on with the pirates, and they like him. And eventually he jokingly threatens that when he gets his ransom paid and goes back to Rome, he'll come back and slit their throats. And they say, oh, what a lovely fellow, what a nice man, of course you'd never do that. Well, the ransom was paid and Caesar did go back and allegedly slit their throats.
So, one by one.
Well, we don't know.
What, crucified them?
Yep,
on crosses, yes, which he put along the coast. And they hung there.
Exactly, as an example.
For years.
Yeah. So so he was very charming, but when he said he was going to do something, he went back and he did it exactly as he said. And that's kind of the character indication that comes through from the pirate story. Nice, but don't mess with him.
So from an early time, Tom, he obviously has this extraordinary force of personality.
Yes. Mm.
Does he?
Yes. Yes, I was going to say, in that case, he was building up his idea of himself as a very merciful man, uh-huh, and he was merciful because, as Catherine said, he'd threatened the pirates when he was in their clutches. I must say, he did have great tickets on himself. They had actually asked for a ransom of 20 talents. A talent is a weight of silver.
Mm-hmm.
And he laughed them to scorn, saying, I am Caesar. I am worth more than that. And he demanded that they ask for 50 talents as his ransom.
Who paid the ransom?
Oh, he then sent friends out who were travelling with him to the various cities of Asia Minor to bring the money back. And then he had sworn to the pirates. He was actually miffed because he was reading the pirates' poetry, his own poetry, while he was in the pirate camp, and they thought very slightingly of the poems. And he said, I will crucify you when I get out. But being a kind man, he slit their throats first, because crucifixion is a long and excruciating death. And if you're ever faced with crucifixion and you have the option of having your throat cut, take it.
Yeah. For sure.
All right. He comes back to Rome. We have to take a few jumps in a sense because it's a long story, the story of Julius Caesar.
I'm afraid.
He had an extraordinary number of... He goes to Spain on a military expedition, doesn't he?
He does. So
there he sees a statue.
Look, there's two extraordinary things that happened, and we can do them very rapidly. Mm. First of all, he has a career.
Mm.
And now, coming from the wrong side of the Civil War, he shouldn't have had a career, but he does. And I think it's his mother's relatives who make sure that he gets his career. And he goes up the normal ladder of offices for a young Roman. And basically, you take an office in the city and then you go off and take some provincial command. So twice he goes to Spain, in different areas of Spain. And we have this story told about both occasions, so we're not exactly sure when it happened.
So the Romans control Spain at this stage.
Oh yeah, well, most of it, yes, yeah, and yeah, certainly they're fighting,
but
for
not
the control.
Gaul at this stage.
Not Gaul yet,
absolutely, which is France,
only the bottom bit of Gaul they have. Mm. But anyway, the story is that he comes across a temple of Hercules, and inside there's a statue of Alexander. And so the statue of Alexander is there. Alexander dies at the age of 33, having conquered most of the known world. And Caesar weeps tears because he has not in any way achieved at a similar age what Alexander has. So the story's a little bit malleable. We don't know quite whether it happens when he's around 30 or a little bit older, but certainly this story resonates and is told by several authors.
But he decides that he's going to make something of his life because he feels that he hasn't.
He feels that he's been left behind.
So, Catherine, the highest office that anyone can aspire to in ancient Rome is the consulship.
It is.
But he gets there, doesn't he? How does he get there?
Well,
this is the kind of top of the tree for him, isn't it?
He'd planned this very carefully. So you get several chances to present yourself in front of the Roman people. This is where a military career, if you've had a successful military career, is a tremendous publicity stunt in terms of your career profile. But Caesar has also taken one step, a very expensive office, which is responsible for putting on games and for the general maintenance of the city. And so this was another chance.
So he's in charge of stadiums.
Is it? Yeah, more or less. So I think Tom's looked up the figures on what he contributed to his games. So I think we might have a few of those first.
How many elephants did he slaughter?
No, that was Pompey.
Pompey did the elephants. Caesar did lions. He did lots of lions. I mean, there's this terrible inflation going on in Rome with everyone wanting to do one better than the last. And so Rome actually denudes the Mediterranean basin of its natural wildlife in this course, but also gladiatorial games. And Caesar had one of the largest troops arranged. He had 320 pairs of gladiators ready to go.
Wow.
300 pairs. And this was within a decade of the great slave revolt of Spartacus.
So, who pays for all this, though?
Well, that's an interesting question. So the Roman state pays the base rate. But if you are an ambitious politician, you're going to be trying to find the money to upgrade and so that your games are bigger and better than anybody else's.
So basically,
he'll be borrowing money.
Corruption is rife everywhere.
He will be borrowing money. Mm-hmm. In fact, he's said to have, on the morning he went to get elected as Pontifex Maximus, he's alleged to have said to his mother, "I'll come back today either Pontifex Maximus or completely broke." I mean, there was no way forward. But the other thing he did that was extraordinary was, remember Marius? Uncle Marius comes back into the story because he gets every statue that of Marius that had been knocked over, destroyed completely. He gets every one of them remade. And then in a single night, we're told, whether we believe this or not, in a single night, he puts up all the statues where they had originally stood. So he's got this flair for the great public moment to make himself stand out from the crowd. And this is beyond being a military genius. Rome had plenty of them. This is really fine publicity.
Okay, so the people love him.
They do, and Plutarch actually, the source for this, the biography, Plutarch actually says people had forgotten how many statues there were and how amazing they were, and everybody was talking about this act of resurrecting the statues.
His term as consul expires. He has to leave. He gets posted to Gaul, or he goes to Gaul. Now, this is unconquered at this stage, Tom.
Yes, indeed. I mean,
he fixes that up pretty soon.
There's a thin path that the Romans can take to Spain along the south coast of what is now France, but otherwise they have nothing else.
They can't go into any of what we would call France at all.
Caesar is very keen to make his mark. And just going back, actually, to that point about the consulship and his idolship, the idea was that if you throw games so that everyone will be in awe of what you can do and they forget everybody else. And he has this poor colleague who actually becomes, as Catherine was saying at the beginning when we were talking about the Republic, everybody has a colleague. And he had someone who was a contemporary of his called Calpurnius Bibulus, who was always sharing the same offices. And he always complained that no one ever knew he was there. And they have twin gods at Rome called Castor and Pollux. And he said, I am Castor to his Pollux, I'm Pollux to his Castor, because everyone just talks about the Temple of Castor, but there are two of them, and he never got noticed. So it was the same in the consulship. So Caesar goes out to Gaul, determined to make a big splash.
Now he's a very adept military commander.
Yes, indeed.
Is he just that he blows his own trumpet in history? But no, he actually is, because his campaigns are very effective.
He's extraordinarily effective,
Can you explain why? Why were the Romans so successful?
One is that they had a number of gifted generals, and Caesar was a gifted general. Mm. Although Caesar often made quite serious mistakes, which he gives us evidence for in his own commentaries on the wars. But by that stage, the army was extraordinarily professional, and you could tell the Roman army to do something, and they would do it. He talks about there's a particular battle at the River Sombra in 58 BC where they get surprised, and everything just goes to could have gone to pieces. But Caesar himself says the army knew what to do. The centurions who led the centuries knew what to do, and when the centurions, most of them were killed in this battle, but the army knew what to do. And there's a tremendous in this professional army, there's a pride amongst the soldiers themselves when they see the general. And Caesar makes much of the fact that he was always there at a crucial moment. And when they saw the general, they knew how to behave.
So he led from the front, did he?
Yeah.
And often. This is the case. And we hear of the centurions competing with each other. In fact, there were two particular centurions he talked about who were always outdo each other, and their names were Lucius Varanus and Titus Pullo. And that might ring a bell with people who have seen the HBO Rome series. Yes. Those two characters who are the were actually mentioned by Julius Caesar and his commanders, always out there to outdo each other. So the army was extraordinarily professional. And when he wanted to do something to make a literal splash, he decides he's going to intimidate the Germans by putting a bridge across the Rhine. And he says to his army, I want you to make a bridge.
And no one had ever done this?
No.
So the Romans had never, ever gone across the Rhine?
That was the first. And everyone back in Rome hears in the same year that he's gone across the Rhine and he's gone across the English Channel. It must have been a spectacular news getting back. And in terms of what the Germans saw coming, it's like War of the Worlds. They would have seen these rafts coming out and pile drivers building these drilling these uprights into the Rhine, which would have been about 400 metres wide at the time, in some places 25 metres deep. And they're watching this bridge coming towards them. That must have been an incredibly intimidating thing to see. But his army could do that.
And I think, too, we've got to give him tremendous credit for building his relationship with the army. I did a study of this a long time ago where I saw how he I observed how he spoke about his fellow officers, and he'll leave them aside, but he will glorify the centurions, as Tom's pointed out. He will really, as he writes up the wars, he's very careful to name the centurions, to put them into the story, to put the soldiers into the story. You can tell he knows his audience and he's writing for them.
Well, I'm just a bit puzzled as to, I mean, in a modern state, waging war, of course, is a conscious decision by the state for a particular end.
Yes.
Much of what Caesar seems to be doing seems to be kind of buccaneering.
Well, no, not quite. He had a legal command, which was long, but it was for 5 years and then extended by 5 years.
To conquer as much as he can.
Basically, and then, of course, the whole way through the Gallic Wars, he's giving you more and more excuses as to why he has to go a little bit further. Mm-hmm. So his first war is against the Helvetii. Well, they were invading the space and upsetting some of the Rome's Gallic allies, so they had to be protected. Then, of course, he runs across Ariovistus, the German, who is claiming a little bit of Gaul for himself. Well, you can't have that because that's upsetting some of Rome's allies. And so bit by bit by bit, he finds new wars and new tribes to conquer under the aegis of this command that he's been awarded by Rome. So he has got a legal authority from the Roman centre to go, but pretty much every general has to make a call. We've got very strange communications here. You know, they're back in Rome, you're up in Gaul. You have to be able to justify, but you can pretty much justify why you would extend the war a little bit further or a little bit further. And it happens over a long time. It doesn't all happen at once.
We will decide which Gauls cross our territory.
Yes.
And when.
And Germans.
But and he also Germans. Crosses the channel, doesn't he? And,
yes.
And so presumably he had to build ships to do that.
He had ships. He wasn't tremendously good on ships, as he found out in the Civil War, that his opponents were much better on ships than he was. But he had ships fit for purpose. And, of course, by this stage too, part of what he's doing is getting certain Gallic tribes on side as well. So he's using their resources.
So he's got a lot of mercenaries.
Not so much mercenaries, but allies, I would say.
Mm, yeah. Okay. So hostility between France and Britain is very long.
Oh, yes.
It's very deep-seated.
Absolutely. As you will know if you read Asterix in Britain.
Exactly. He has a crack at the British once, doesn't he? He doesn't get that far. He has, I think, two cracks at them before he actually manages to make any significant headway, doesn't he, Tom?
He tried it in 55 BC first, and he got the tides wrong. Yeah. Once again, we hear of the reaction that the the natives must have had as they watched the Romans coming in, because they'd never seen transport ships such as he had with cavalry.
So here they are loaded with soldiers.
But, of course, then they pull up on the beach, and then it's a high tide. It's a full moon, a very high tide, and the ships go to pieces. A lot of them go to pieces. He's in a lot of trouble the first time around. So he pulls back, makes a strategic retreat in 55 BC, but he's back in 54 BC.
And this time, it's curtains for the British.
Well, not quite. He doesn't extend all that far. The big conquest of Britain doesn't happen until basically the time of Claudius. But he does enough to claim that he's the first one to have done it.
Mm. He plants the flag and says, you know, Pax Romana is also in Britain.
Pax.
Not much Pax. Not much Pax.
Bellum Romanum.
Lots of Romana, but not much Pax.
That's right.
Meanwhile, back in Rome, things are not going so well for him. I mean, he might be a great military leader. And, of course, presumably his popularity in that sense has increased, hasn't it, amongst the populace?
And, of course,
things are going, and here we get to the crunch, don't we?
Well, he made a lot of enemies in the 60s. He made a lot of enemies through his consulship, and that's building. And also, as we're thinking about a society that's still getting over that first civil war, some of them are deeply afraid as well. So there's a lot of fear about this commander who's just getting very, very, very good at what he does, and more famous and very rich. I mean, Tom's got the figures for how much, how many people were killed, but the amount of money that he's able to accrue through the Gallic conquest personally, as well as for the state.
So he's acquired huge treasure.
He's getting a lot of money. And this, of course, is going to upset any kind of political balance back in Rome.
So they order him to come back.
Well,
fighting and come back?
They try. I'm going to hand over to Tom on this one.
This is where we get to the famous Rubicon.
They were getting very worried. I mean, he'd started out with something like 5 legions in 58 BC, and by the time he's up to 10, I think, by the time of 50 BC. And he's got a...
How many soldiers in a legion?
He's got a track, about 4,200.
Right. If he's 4,000, so if he's got 10 legions, that's 40... That's an army of 40,000.
Yes.
And that would be unstoppable.
And they're an army who have been working together for the best part of a decade. And so
An army that's been fighting for 10 years together of 40,000...
And who
are being enriched by...
Are being enriched and who think that Caesar is a genius.
Mm. Yeah. That's so they're back in Rome, they think we have to put an end to this.
Yes.
Basically.
So they say, you've got to come back. Do they, or do they say... take us to the Rubicon. How do we get there?
His peers back in Rome, I think he's getting incredibly more popular with the people. But the other senators in Rome think here's someone's getting out of control. Mm. And so he's got a command which isn't going to run out officially until March 49 BC, but they start making noises about he's done what he had to do in Gaul so he can come home troops a break. And then they come up with all sorts of plans for taking some of his legions away, and he actually gives 2 of his legions away, etc. But finally... it's time for him to come back in 49 BC, and he knows that the courts are stacked against him. And if he comes back, he's going to be prosecuted. Some people actually wanted to prosecute him for some illegal actions. For war crimes. He'd begun some of those campaigns on his own initiative rather than coming to the state.
So it was a slight matter of massacring the Germans.
So he thinks if I come back to Rome, all that's going to happen is that they'll put me on trial and I'll be executed, or I'll be stripped of power.
Probably exiled.
Exiled. Yeah. So after all my glory and my triumph, this is not going to end well if I come back to Rome like that. So he decides, and as you say, marching on Rome with an army is a big thing.
He does try one political ploy first, and that is that he's hoping to come directly from his military command, his proconsulship, back to Rome, and to be elected consul again in absentia so that he would go from command to new office, and that way, because you couldn't prosecute somebody who was actually in office.
But have you can't, he couldn't do that unless you're back in Rome.
He could, because he'd got this special law passed giving him permission to stand out while he was still outside Rome. So he tries this, and his political enemies are absolutely making sure that he can't do this.
Okay.
So there's a push and pull on the politics, and everybody's quite scared.
And so he actually says, well, I'll come back to stand for office with bringing my army back to vote for me. And that's the Rubicon is that it's a very small little stream.
It's not actually a big river, is it?
You could wade across it.
It's not. But we use the phrase because it was a fateful decision. Was
yes.
If once he'd once he was over the Rubicon, he was into Italy.
It's the barrier.
It's the border.
It's the border between his province and Italian soil, and he's not supposed to bring his army.
So
over
once
he
brought his army border. Across that river, it was an act of. Of war, of civil disobedience.
And, and Caesar himself is supposed to have said, alia iacta est, the dice are cast. You know, he's throwing the dice in the air when as he crosses the Rubicon. In fact, he said it in Greek. He's actually thinking of a Greek comedy, but that's another story. But he knows that's the final.
So he knows when he does this that there is a great cataclysm coming.
Yes.
That if he wants to take power in Rome, he'll have to fight for it militarily.
Well, yes.
Or does he think that... Does he think that they'll just give up and in the face of his overwhelming odds, as it were?
It was very clear that wasn't going to happen. Basically, his opponents, led at this point by Pompey, vacate Rome. They fall back. And so they just take everybody, they get everyone that they can down to southern Italy, very close to the port whereby you could go across to northern Greece. And they pull back, apart from one person who Caesar lets go and who wasn't meant to be there anyway, they pull back and they gather everybody and get them onto ships and they all leave Italy. And I don't think Caesar expected that. So, indeed, he has no ships, so he can't even chase them. So there was a war pending, but by withdrawing from Italy, you actually... There's no army there. Caesar can walk into Rome without troops there.
So he does, and he becomes dictator of Rome.
First of all, he then decides when he can't follow Pompey across to Greece, he goes to Spain. And his big campaigns in 49 are actually against Pompey's generals over in Spain.
Because he basically beats his opposition.
He beats them. He comes back, and there's just 11 days at the end of the year, and... How are elections going to happen? Because the consuls are with Pompey over in Greece, so there's no system, there's no one to run them, the whole system is in abeyance, and there's a big question mark. In fact, by vacating Rome, Pompey had been quite clever because he's taking all legitimacy away from Caesar and not fighting a battle. But he just lost the battle later on. But we find that the only way that Caesar can hold elections is to make himself dictator. So he's made a dictator for the first time for just 11 days. And dictator to hold the elections, and guess who gets elected? Consul. So this is then the beginning of his slow takeover of the Roman government. It isn't just a case of making him dictator and all of this. They have all of these legal argy-bargy that puts him into the situation where he's in control again, in legitimate control.
Here's the question. Was Caesar just a megalomaniac power grabber who wanted to enrich himself and acquire as much power as he could? Or did he actually seriously think, because he thought long and hard about the Roman Republic, did he think the Roman Republic is broken in many, many ways and I need to fix it, and so the only person who could fix it is me?
Well, that's the big question.
Yes.
And
what do you think?
Well, I pose this question to my students, you know, could one man be responsible for the end of the Republic? And someone proofreading the paper drew a smiley face and just wrote yes. So there are historians who believe that the Republic was already broken and that Caesar stepped in to fix it, and that he was the great man, the great visionary who would bring about order from the chaos and a system that was stable. And these the people that take this view are also incredibly influential in writing the narratives that we still read. Big German names from the middle of the 19th century that really, really saw Caesar as the perfect politician, the perfect general, the perfect human being.
The great man.
Yes.
The great man in history.
The absolute great man who saw the problems and saw how to fix it.
Mm. I think that's the popular view, in a sense,
yes,
isn't it?
Is
that,
yes.
The great man who was brought down and indeed assassinated by smaller men.
Yeah.
Smaller men with nasty and small political ambitions.
Absolutely. Yes. And this view resonates through history and it dominates the actual narratives that we have. However, if we look at it from the point of view of those that were there at the time, what's really interesting about the group who assassinated him is that it crossed the political spectrum of the day. So where Caesar looked like a great visionary to others, to those that were around him, he did look like this megalomaniac person who was going to take over the entire system and center it all on himself after what they believed of was 500 years of a tradition of power sharing. And it's that clash,
Tom,
that's interesting.
Here's another mystery, Tom. If he's such a famous general and such a famous fighter, why does he get jumped so simply and seemingly so easily, and he's not even armed at the time? Now, take us through this famous assassination.
No.
What actually happened?
He'd actually dismissed his guard. He actually had a very large bodyguard of Spaniards who were around him, and he let them go. And he's supposed to have said on the eve of his death, when he was asked what sort of a death he would like, a quick death. Mm. Some people actually, Suetonius, one of his biographers, says that he was sort of half expecting it. But it's, as Catherine says, the opposition to him is coming now from all spectrum.
They think he's an autocrat, a dictator.
So it's not one side or another. And he must have been blindsided by just how many of his own friends were coming after him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the conspiracy entailed 60 men, we're told, by one of our ancient sources. How you keep...
Did they have a clear objective?
Killing Caesar.
Killing Caesar.
That was it. So that was it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
How do you... Because
like the current coup in Canberra, perhaps.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, the next step was a little bit not...
Unclear.
23 of them actually got their daggers into him in the...
Really?
He died with 23 stab wounds in there, and from 23...
But did he really not see it coming?
No.
I'm going to say no.
No, yeah. I'll say no also. I think he was actually taken completely by surprise.
Why? He was the most connected, powerful person that Rome had ever seen. Why did he not see it coming?
If we think about we left him a dictator for 11 days. He takes on several dictatorships after that, and he, just 1 month before this, he's been made perpetual dictator. That is, dictator without an end to his term. Yes.
Yeah.
So he could choose to step down, but nobody was going to make him. And it's not an extraordinary thing that it's singly just 1 month between that title and the assassination. It was the last straw for a number of people, and so the resistance to him is quite stark. And what's truly interesting is that two of the people that were part of the conspiracy were very close friends. And so it isn't just that it's the other side coming in, like Brutus and Cassius are connected with the Pompeian side of the Civil War. It's not just men like this. It's actually his own closest friends, one of whom was named as an heir to a second or third degree in his will.
Mm.
That's how close they were.
Okay, so 23 separate stab wounds, that's that's quite a lot. Did he actually ever say et tu, Brute?
No, actually. He said it in Greek. He died saying kai sou technon, which is and you. Technon means child, and people have actually thought that might have been a reference to Brutus being his child, which is not going to work. But it's kai sou means and you, and it could be a Greek saying meaning and the same to you. It's almost an aversion of the evil eye, and he could be saying, same to you, kid. That could be his final words.
Mm.
But he was conscious of his dignity up until the very last moment. We're told that he unloosed his tunic so it fell to cover his ankle so there would be no unseemly display of limbs while he fell to the floor. I mean, is that conscious of his place as Julius Caesar? He will die properly if he's going to die.
Or people who describe the death. We're going to make it clear.
Tom Hillard and Catherine Welch with us. We're talking about the life and times of Julius Caesar, who who dies in 44 BC. So he's what? He's 56 at the time he dies. Is he? So so he's actually he's getting on in a sense. I don't know what life expectancy is like in ancient Rome. Is it?
He could have lived for another 20 to 30 years. We wouldn't know.
Following his death, of course, there's, I mean, there's chaos. There's the whole, we've skipped over many things, of course.
We have.
We've, we've skipped over his dalliance with Cleopatra, for example. His anointed heir, who becomes Augustus in the end, wins the series of battles and civil war dramas that occur at the end of all this, and thus begins the Roman Empire. So Caesar's the bookend of the Republic, is he?
He's one of those dates that you can stop a unit of study at. So, you know, you can say we've got to the Rubicon, we've got Caesar dead. Yes. Well, just get him down to his assassination. Fine, we'll stop 49 or 44, and then we can pick up again for the Augustan period starting in 27. Mm. And I've made my career out of the bit in the middle, so clearly.
Did he have a child with Cleopatra, Tom?
Cleopatra claims so. Yeah. She named her son Caesarion after Caesar, and I don't see any reason really to doubt the fact.
Yeah.
We don't have another claimant as father, put it that way.
But wouldn't the world again have been a different world had Caesar lived on and Cleopatra lived on and they shared a son?
What do we see of his legacy today? What do we think of it? Do we think this was the... It was hardly it wasn't as a matter of fact, was it? It wasn't the high point of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire actually continued to expand.
It did
mightily after this.
Yes, and in its phase as under the emperors, lasted much longer even than the Republic. Hmm. No, it's not that. It is this great story of the death. The fact that one of the assassins, Brutus, becomes almost as famous as Caesar. So the whole. The two characterizations of Caesar and Brutus live on in our literature. What Shakespeare does with Marcus Antonius to turn him into such a dominating and interesting character in the Julius Caesar, that's another thread. And the whole story then of Antony and Cleopatra, far more interesting than any story we ever tell about Augustus, that lives on in the popular imagination. So there's just so much there that's so rich in stories. And then this big trajectory of change of government, of how it's all going to operate.
I said that he gave us the Julian calendar. I mean, it's hard to overemphasize the sophistication of the Romans and what they had. They didn't have electricity.
No.
But they pretty much had everything else that we think of as an aid to modern life. They had hydraulics. They had they could reticulate water. They had levers, ropes, pulleys. They could build
all
things. They had mortar. They had bricks. They had mortar.
Got a wonderful image on a gravestone of a Roman crane, except that within the crane wheels there's little human beings actually pedalling the crane. And this thing's reaching up over something like four or five stories. I don't think their workplace health and safety rules were particularly good.
And he gave us what we call the Julian calendar, which is actually our calendar now.
It is, with moderation. Could I suggest, though, that he got it from Alexandria?
That was
a leftover of the time with Cleopatra.
When he was hanging out with Cleopatra, yes. he thought that the Egyptians had quite a few things going.
So he brings in Sosigenes,
or the Greeks. Mm. The Greeks in Egypt had a thing going.
Yes,
but the Roman calendar was getting out. The Roman calendar was a sort of monthly calendar based on the lunar cycle,
and it got way out of whack.
It was getting completely. It was 3 months out of whack by 46 BC when he.
So when they said it was the height of summer, it was in fact
exactly. And this is very important in a society that believes that the gods are so important. You have to be celebrating the right gods at the right time. And if you are 3 months out of whack with the solar system, you're not praying to the right gods at the right time.
Mm. Does any Roman, just very briefly, does any Roman ever have as much power as he does at the height of his power?
Oh, yes.
Again?
Yes.
They do. The emperors do, don't they?
They do. But I don't think any of them has the same cocktail of magic in terms of literature, in terms of military prowess, in terms of political interest. It's unique in its time. Mm. Yep.
Yes, a wonderful story. We have, as you rightly said, Catherine, admitted a lot. but if it's prompted you to read some more, then do so. These stories, and for kids too, these stories are just some of the great stories of our culture and our civilization. Pleasure talking with you. Catherine Welch is professor at the University of Sydney. Tom Hillard's professor at the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie University. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Very welcome.
Pax Romana. More Pax and less Romana, I suppose.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.